convene the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. Today on our agenda, we have an informational meeting on the juvenile justice system. And before the bill introductions, are you waiting for the bill introduction?
Yeah, because I.
Well, let's wait until we can go into that when we get. So let's go into this. Do you want to lead off?
Yes. Good morning, members. What we have on the schedule today is an informational meeting, an overview of the juvenile justice system. In the next couple of weeks, you'll be starting in on budgets for the Criminal Justice Commission and the Oregon Youth Authority, both of who are part of that juvenile justice system. And we thought it would be useful before we got into the budget detail to have a presentation on the system overall and how it works, because there are some differences between the juvenile system and the adult system that are worth hearing about. So we have Karen Brazeau this morning, who is the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and Phil Lemon, who's the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and they have a presentation for us.
Well, welcome. Yeah, come on forward. And
your cue.
I'm Karen Brazeau, the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'm going to begin, and then Phil will jump in a little here. Charts I have are in the handouts that you have.
Thank you.
And we really just wanted to set a context for the budgets that you will hear. And we know that there's a lot of focus on juvenile crime prevention, and our agencies are also focused on juvenile crime prevention. Though a lot of what you hear about juvenile crime prevention is really the focus on primary prevention, which is the early primary prevention, the more universal preventions that happen with children 0 to 8. And we believe that our agencies also play a part in juvenile crime prevention. And so we want to establish the context for that. And it seems confusing, and it is confusing, because there are a lot of players and there is some overlap, and there's reasons for that, and so we'll talk about that a little bit. What this chart represents is kind of the intensity and the cost of preventing and dealing with juveniles and youth and doing crime prevention. Early intervention or primary prevention is targeted at universal prevention, the kind of stuff that you hope all children have, is good parents, generalized good nutrition, all of those good things that you hope all kids get, is relatively inexpensive and targeted at all kids. And the more targeted the prevention becomes, the fewer children it serves, and the expense goes up. So when you talk about one of the programs that's proposed for early intervention in this legislative session is the screening of all first births. that's clearly aimed at very early intervention. It's relatively inexpensive. It is targeted, but it still is targeted at a much broader population than, say, the Oregon Youth Authority, which is clear over here on the tertiary end of prevention, serving 3,000 kids, but is very, very expensive in comparison. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families is responsible for comprehensive planning for children 0 to 18. So they kind of have the umbrella planning effort for all of this. And Phil's shop has responsibility for the crime prevention efforts that go on more in the secondary area of juvenile crime prevention, and I provided a handout there that has some kind of basic definitions, whereas the Oregon Youth Authority is more involved in what we call tertiary prevention, meaning we're involved with those kids who have already committed crimes, and our efforts are aimed at trying to keep those young people from moving farther into the criminal world and going on to adult corrections or a lifetime of criminal activity where their costs are even an increased burden to the general public. And as you can see, it's just based on this chart, it's a smaller number of kids, but the costs are much, much greater. So we kind of drew this as a way to get a perspective about all of these crime prevention efforts and how to think about it, because it is a continuum and it all is necessary to have a concerted effort against or trying to mitigate against juvenile crime, that you can put all of the programs in place up front here and there will still continue to be kids who break through those efforts for whatever reasons, that continue to engage in risk behaviors and end up in these higher risk situations and eventually do commit crimes and end up in the custody of the state. We hope it's fewer and fewer kids. And in fact, when you hear about the youth authorities, when you hear the youth authorities budget, you will see that there are youth arrests are down and commitments to the youth authority are down. But the kind of agencies that provide these services, so primary prevention are families, community groups, schools, local governments, and state governments, secondary preventions. We still have families doing those kinds of programs and schools through alternative schools and specialized counseling. A lot of secondary prevention goes on through the local juvenile departments. In fact, most of the juvenile services in the states are provided by local governments through the local juvenile programs that are operated by the county governments. There are about 40 to 50,000 kids a year arrested. Most of those kids are referred to their local juvenile departments. Most of them are never seen again by the local juvenile departments. And those who are seen again most of those are dealt with successfully by their local juvenile departments. Again, only 3,000 of those kids come into the custody of the state for the tertiary prevention efforts at the state level. So that kind of trying to give you a context of the juvenile justice system, and the Criminal Justice Commission's efforts are in here primarily in the secondary prevention efforts, with the youth authorities again being in the tertiary prevention area.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Trow?
Where does the gang prevention kinds of activities that we do, counseling for gangs, whatever it is we do, the Portland legislators are especially concerned that funding has dropped away from programs affecting the activity of gangs. I was wondering, where does that come in on the chart, and who's in, that's an OYA program, isn't it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, those programs would be considered secondary in nature. They're funds that flow through the youth authority's budget to the local detention or local juvenile departments, and they provide those programs locally to kids who have already gotten in trouble. They're not kids who are serious enough to have come into state custody. The youth authority also provides anti-gang kinds of counseling programs for kids who have come into its custody, but I think the programs that you're hearing about are ones that have in the past been funded through the youth authority by the state with flow through dollars back to the counties.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Are those kids that clearly, if they're in gang activity, they're high risk for getting into difficulty and going through your system, or?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. So do these programs that we have been funding have a record of helping to divert them from that activity? Are they successful as a diversion?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, those are programs that were funded prior to the state having an emphasis on specific outcome measures. So I believe that the people who are operating those programs believe very genuinely that they are important deterrents in their communities. They have not been evaluated to the point that I feel like I can say absolutely that they are effective. Clearly, the folks in Multnomah County, which is the only county that has received those funds, believe that they're an important.
Has that been entirely state funds, or are there federal funds for gang activities? How is that funded?
The funds that come through the Youth Authority have been entirely general funds. They have been combined at the local level with a variety of funds to build gang prevention programs at the local level.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
That's fine. I want to suspend this informational meeting for just a brief moment and move into a work session for purposes of introduction of a LC draft 4127. There's no real reason to spend a lot of time on it. It relates to dispute resolution. This particular draft deletes a provision related to the 20% revenue transfer to the Department of Administrative Services. The revenue retained by the Dispute Resolution Commission, which will distribute the funds, is provided by law for public policy dispute resolution. As with all bill drafts, our adoption of this particular bill draft does not necessarily represent our support of this idea. And that is something that I would suggest, since I don't necessarily agree with the bill draft myself. But I'm willing to, at the request of the great high co-chairs, advance this particular draft. So if there's no discussion, no objection, Senator Trow would move the introduction of LC 4127. Is there discussion, objection, hearing and seeing none, is ordered. Thank you, Robin.
And someone to carry it in full. Somebody has to say something in full.
I'll say something. I'd be glad to say something.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll reconvene the informational hearing. Thank you. And please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Phil Lemon, Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. The Criminal Justice Commission administers the high-risk juvenile crime prevention grants that the legislature established and funded in the last biennium. And so I'm here to give you a little process history and a little overview about how that fits into the rest of the juvenile justice system. I'd like to take you back just a little bit to 1994 when we had the first Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Crime Prevention. That was primarily in response to a very dramatically increasing juvenile crime rate, juvenile arrest rate, and we wanted to look at different ways to address that. You probably remember, or many of you do, Senate Bill 1, which passed in 1995, that contains very fundamental changes in the entire juvenile justice system, and also was used to implement Senate Bill 1, or excuse me, Ballot Measure 11 for juvenile offenders. And so that was the primary focus in 1994. In 1996, there was a second task force that focused more on the prevention side. And there was we had a wonderful process and lengthy process among all the interested parties involved in juvenile crime prevention. And last session, this body approved Senate Bill 555, which created what we call the JCPAC, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, which is designed to get all the players together, advise the legislature and governor on juvenile crime prevention policies, and then review the county plans that use this funding that you gave us last session. But that is more focused on the prevention end rather than the juvenile departments and the youth authority side of things. And I would add that Representative Canope and Senator Durfler are the legislative members on the JCPAC. We have many people from state agencies, Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Youth Authority, Department of Corrections, State Police, I serve on it, Department of Human Services, Alcohol and Drug, and then we have many of the local counterparts as well, juvenile directors, mental health directors, we have a school superintendent and some other folks. The legislature appropriated $20 million last funding. We have $1 million for administration and evaluation and $19 million that goes out to the counties for grants. Of that, about two-thirds or $13 million was earmarked for prevention services and $6 million was earmarked for what we call basic services. The general distinction is that basic services are services delivered to kids who have committed offenses, and those are primarily delivered through the juvenile departments. Prevention services are more addressed to the risk factors that add up to predict crime. And so if we can reduce those risk factors, we believe that we can actually reduce people from either getting involved in the juvenile justice system in the first place, or if they're already in, to limit their advancement through that system, either by committing multiple offenses or committing more serious offenses. So that's how we make the distinction between prevention services and basic services. We did allow a waiver process, so counties could request permission to either address a different target population or to move money between prevention and basic services. As a result of that, in this biennium, we spent about 60% on prevention and 40% on basic. A lot of that came from especially the smaller counties where they do not have adequate resources to have a continuum of sanctions for their juvenile offenders, and so many of the smaller counties in particular spent most or all their prevention service money on those basic services. The purpose of these funds were to reduce juvenile crime in Oregon. We wanted to increase the coordination and planning efforts, and in Senate Bill 555, as Karen mentioned, there's a comprehensive plan, or there will be a comprehensive plan in each county for children 0 to 18. This juvenile crime prevention plan is one slice of that. And so the intent was to have every county pay more attention to coordinating their efforts locally and then have a parallel effort at the state. And so we have hopefully better coordination at the state level and at the local level, and that will follow up.
Senator Trowell.
As the governor sort of reallocated monies that were going to the Children's Commission, I know to put into his new prevention program at an earlier age, at least the people in Benton County were rather convinced that monies were flowing out of programs like the ones you're talking about and into this new prevention initiative. There's just not enough money there to do both, apparently. Is that a concern, or am I wrong on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, I can't give you a complete answer on that. What I can tell you is that from the Criminal Justice Commission budget, there were no funds cut. We did not get the full CSL amount, but there is increased funds over the 9901 level to fund these crime prevention grants, and I'll let Ms. Brazeau speak for what happened to the OIA budget.
So at least in your budget, but how about the Children's Commission, the Commission for Children and Families, do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, I'm not familiar enough with
what
that budget.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I have the Commission on Children and Families budget as well. The money that's in the Commission on Children's and Families budget to some extent is redirected from some programs within the Commission, from the Babies First program in the Health Division, and a program called Together for Children in Department of Education. Those are the major elements, and then there's some new money added in as well. So in the Commission on Children and Families, there's a flexible funding stream called Juvenile Services, and that's cut by about 56%, and that money is redirected to the children's plan. Now that's a 0-18 flexible funding stream. So they took some of the money out of that and put it into the early childhood piece. There was a student retention initiative of about $1.8 million that got redirected. There was a court services piece of a little less than $1 million that got redirected into that. And I think part of the thinking there was that instead of having that small pot of court services money going through the commission, there are more resources now and more targeted through these funding streams through the Criminal Justice Commission and OYA. So I think that was part of the rationale there. And then there were some general funds for what's called a family preservation and support program. About $2 million of that was redirected. And so there's various pieces that get shifted to that early childhood focused. And that budget has been heard in the Human Services Subcommittee. They haven't gotten to a work session on it, though. But there are a lot of issues about where the money's coming from and how it's being used.
Is the redirection just sort of absolute, or is it... is there some kind of local discretion as to whether or not money should be redirected?
The dollar amount of the redirection is specified, and the general purposes of the redirection is specified. Is that it's an early childhood assessment and home visitation and support system. But the local commissions will have some flexibility in terms of how they set that up at the local level.
Thanks. Sorry.
No problem. I think that's a good question, because when we hear about the OYA budget, part of the reason they might be in trouble is the redirection. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As part of Senate Bill 555, it established the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, which is the policy group that overviews these plans and makes sure that we have measurable outcomes and are trying to focus on these high-risk youth. The kids that we're talking about, again, are generally 10 to 17 years old. They have two or more risk factors involving family management, school failure. They are demonstrating behaviors that are going to get their attention to either service agencies or government agencies. They're hanging out with the wrong people, and they're using drugs or alcohol. And so those probably don't sound too mysterious, or it's kind of common sense, but those are the research-based factors that as they accumulate, and they increasingly predict the likelihood that juvenile is going to end up in trouble with the law at some point. And so that's the group that we wanted to focus on to, again, see if we could stop them from coming into the juvenile justice system or limit their involvement with it if they're already in. The JCPAC invited Professor Del Elliott, who's one of the nationally renowned researchers in juvenile crime prevention. He's based in Colorado, to come out and talk to us. And I just wanted to highlight a couple things that he told us. There's kind of two general patterns of juvenile offenders, and Karen will get into this a little more later, but you have what they call the early onset kids that you can start identifying about age 5, and they are demonstrating their conduct by either acting out or by substance abuse primarily. About half of them mature out of this by age 12, and the other half generally go on to become serious or chronic offenders. So half of that, it's a relatively small percentage of the overall juvenile offender population, but they start early, and half of them are going to stick with it and are going to be the problem people that we deal with for the rest of their lives and the rest of ours. The other group and the large bulk are what they call the adolescent onset. Their offending years peak at the ages of 16 and 17, and about 80% of them mature out. There's no way that we know of yet to identify those kids at an earlier age. They just kind of start when they get in those teenage years, and then most of them stop. And so, again, if we can focus on that group, that's the largest number of kids, and if we can limit their involvement, then we can save money on down the line. He also talked a little bit about how Colorado...
Senator Trowe.
Do those percentages apply regardless of treatment attempts at helping them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that just defines the population. There are, they display different characteristics and they have different risk factors, and so I would, I'd have to think about a better answer to that, but right now I would say that that's just identifying who these kids are and how they start, and there are different strategies and programs that you would apply to those kids at different times to try to reduce their behavior.
But the 80% are out with programs applied or without programs applied?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trowe, those statistics just reflect what's going on in the United States at the time this research was done.
So some of programs would be applied?
Some, yes, would have had some early intervention programs and some would not. And contrary to what Phil said, my chart didn't arrive. So if I could, can I take a minute here?
Sure. And I would always refer to the director.
Just because it's, I'm going to make an attempt to draw this and I will provide you with the chart of it because it's really, I think, an important, and I'm an ex-teacher, so I love to draw. but I think it's a, it's an important and really either overlooked or ignored piece of information is how this plays out is, the chart looks like this, but there's this group of, if this is like age zero, it starts like this, and there is this group of kids, and it's what you hear about all the time when people say, we could have identified this kid in kindergarten, and there's some truth in that. And they go up like this to about age eight, and then they come down like this. My chart's not going to be right, but about age 12 in here, what you start getting is this other group of kids that really peak at about age 16. They're the kids, and if you think about it, we all know them. They're the kids that you wouldn't have identified. Aha! Uh-huh. Phil's got it.
Mm-hmm. I have one copy.
I'll just pass it around. But they're the, I'll get this to you, but they're the kids that you wouldn't have identified in kindergarten. And if you think about all the horrible news stories that have been in the press recently, they're the kids that...
Those can't be the same kids in those two shades, right?
Right. They're not the same kids. These are the kids that seem to be normal, okay kids, but in adolescence, with all the stresses that go on in adolescence and middle school years, and they're the ones that start, you know, maybe there's a divorce in the family, something happens, the family moves, the curriculum gets too hard, they start failing in school, they get involved in drugs, and their crime escalates. And those are the kids that this crime, these crime prevention efforts are targeted at. Is there is a lot we can do with those preschool kids and those early kids that we know come from the homes that are just sort of destined to produce kids with problems. But there's a lot that can also be done with this group of kids that around middle school, adolescent age, without some interventions, are going to take wrong steps that in this day and age they can't recover from. I mean, I think most of us remember all those kids, and some of us may have been those kids, but used to be able to recover from it, and now they can't.
I'm getting nervous.
I'm sure none of you.
When she talks about
this
age,
way,
I can identify them.
She gets warm in here.
And you can also see from that graph that almost everybody grows out of crime. I don't know if it's just we all get too tired or, you know, something, but. But anyway, that's the group that Phil's program is targeted to intervene with.
So I want to just touch on a couple more subjects, and then I'll turn it back to Karen formally. I want to talk to you a little bit about the planning process that we use to go through this. every county gets to designate generally who participates in developing their plans. The state did mandate that there be several planning partners, just because we know that there were multiple related planning processes that more frequently than we would have liked occurred separately without any communication between them. Thank you. And so those include your alcohol and drug plans, mental health plans. We wanted to involve schools. We wanted to make sure the local commissions on children and families were involved, since they're involved in this comprehensive planning process. And we also want to make sure that the local public safety coordinating councils were involved, since that has the more public safety, criminal justice, and juvenile justice players on that. And the counties really approached it in a lot of different ways. In some counties, the LIPSC was the lead. In most of the counties, it was the local commissions on children and families. We did have one education service district that was the lead planning agency. And I think if there is one weakness that we really need to spend more time on, it's how we involve schools better in this process. I mean, you know better than I do what a lot of the problems the schools are having right now. But because a lot of these kids are in school or having problems in school, we still think that there's a real opportunity and a real need here to get the schools more involved in this planning process and to get them better integrated into this effort. We have some overall goals that every county must include in their plan. One of those is staying within their discretionary bed allocation at the Oregon Youth Authority. Another is that we want to make sure we're able to track the juvenile arrest rate in every county. And then, depending on what programs and activities that each county selects, we want to make sure that each one of those has some measurable outcomes that we can tell what it is this money is producing and how many kids are participating. And so that's kind of the general construct that we're working with, but we do see counties taking very different approaches in terms of whether they emphasize basic services or prevention services and what types of programs and services within each county that they select. In general, some of the prevention programs you will see that are funded, again, address these risk factors, or on the other side of the coin, the protective factors that encourage kids to stay away from crime. Those include after-school programs, alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment, mentoring programs. We've seen quite a few parent training and family support programs, and just a general need for what counties call flexible wraparound services. So when they identify a problem kid, they have some resources available to respond to that on a quick basis and hopefully help turn that kid around. On the basic services side, the primary goal is to enhance community safety and hold youths accountable when they do get in trouble with the law. Those include things like detention beds, shelter beds, supervision, and graduated sanctions. We also wanted to make sure that every county had was aware of and was addressing both cultural competency and gender-specific issues, so that minority youth involved in those counties had effective treatment and services programs available to them, and the same with young girls. As I said, the amount that went out into this program last session was $19 million. We did award minimum grant levels to the smaller counties, and that is a $50,000 level, and I believe there were six or seven of those. The largest grant that we gave out was $3.3 million. All this money is based on the percentage population of 0-17, with the exception of the minimum grants. I want to talk a little bit about evaluation and where we are on that, and we'll give you more detail when I bring my budget in a couple weeks. We have an evaluation contract with Portland State University. Every child that enters a program funded with the juvenile crime prevention money is given a pre-test. And what we do there is it's a test that's given to them to identify what kind of risk factors they have and how many they have. And that gives us the baseline of information to see whether the counties are accurately targeting the right kids for these programs and services, and also allows us to measure their changes in those risk factors when they come out of those programs. And so we have a lot more inputs than outputs right now, and so it's too early for us to really give you a clear look at what effect these programs are having. But what we do know right now is it looks like the counties are doing a very good job in targeting the right kids. And a lot of the kids in these counties have 4 or 5 risk factors instead of the 2. And so, again, we feel pretty comfortable that we're directing the money in the right direction, but it's just a little too early to tell you with any certainty how much good these programs are doing right now.
Senator Kroll.
Are we getting at that latter group of kids, the one that the splurge with this program, or because I thought that we sort of had programs to identify these other kids that start off with all these risk factors at an early age. And so we identify them already, and we've got treatment programs for them. So this is that other group, the teenage takeoff group that causes problems.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, generally, the county plans address kids age 10 to 17.
Uh-huh.
So of those early onset kids, you're going to catch those who are still involved in the system at ages 10 to 17. They will be affected by this money. But you're right, the largest number are going to be the adolescent onset, where they're just starting out or engaging in that activity in their older years.
Now, are there generally different risk factors for these people that that teenage group? Other things you look at other than what you do for the young ones?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, yes. The early onset kids, the way we identify them is early activity in criminal behavior and by substance abuse. And their risk factors relate quite a bit to what's going on in their family. On the adolescent side, it's a little different. The biggest risk factor there is who they're hanging out with. And school failure also plays a big role in that. But they show up in different ways at different times, and there are different strategies to address what their problem is at that point.
Mr. Chair and Senator Trowe, also, I think that early onset kids, typically, if you did a case file review, you would see the history of those kids, or a lot of involvement with state agencies, particularly child protective agencies early on, would be more typical of those early onset kids than later onset kids.
And then what we will be able to, again, the long-term outcomes of these programs is, first of all, to reduce juvenile crime rates. What I can tell you is on the progress board chart, we'd gone from an F in 1998 to a C in 2000. I'd like to be able to take credit for that entirely, but I won't, because I don't think we can honestly do that. We're also going to look at the ongoing recidivism rates, and you'll hear from the Youth Authority about their information systems and how we're going to track that. And then also the biggest effect that we hope to achieve is to keep the number of kids and the number of victims low, and thereby reduce the incarceration cost the state has to pay through the Youth Authority. So I hope that gives you a quick overview, and I'd be glad to answer questions either now or when Ms. Brazeau finishes her presentation.
Questions? Thank you, Phil.
I'd like to finish just with a little bit of information on the juvenile justice information system. I'm not going to go in much to information in our budget. You'll hear that in more detail than you really want to. But you won't hear much about the juvenile justice information system, because the details of that will be heard in the e-government committee. But anytime we talk about the juvenile justice system in Oregon, it's been difficult to talk about, because there really hasn't been much of a system, because it's been each county running its own kind of system and the state running a different system. In fact, the Secretary of State attempted to do an audit on the system a couple of years ago, and that's basically what they said, is you can't audit the system because there isn't a system. So the Youth Authority was funded 4 years ago by this body to develop an information system, and largely based on the requirements of Senate Bill 1, which, as Phil said, was passed in 1995. The bill didn't require an automated system, but it did require the Youth Authority to gather information, that the gathering of which would virtually require an automated system to do. Prior to the development of JGIS, we couldn't even tell you really much about the kids in our own system, and nothing about the kids in the rest of the county systems. A few counties had automated systems, but most had paper and pencil systems. So over the last 4 years, we have put together a system that now links 34 of the 36 counties and the state. Deschutes County and Multnomah County are the two counties that are not linked to JGIS. Deschutes is intending to come online sometime in the next few months. Multnomah has built its own new system, and we are hoping to build an automated interface with them. I would have brought you a demonstration, but it's kind of boring to look at. It's very exciting to use, but to look at. It's a keyboard and a screen. But what it does is has all of the counties, with the exception of those two right now, and the state sharing a common database that is managed by the Department of Administrative Services that shares all the youth in the state from the time of a police referral, when a police referral is made to the county, all the way through the time that the youth, a youth who's in the state's custody, say at McLaren, and it gathers all the information available on that kid so that when a youth is transferred from, say has been placed on, first on probation in Wasco County, maybe the family moves to Lincoln County and the kid continues criminal activity and eventually ends up in the state's custody, we can get into the system and see all of the history on that youth. And it's been incredibly valuable in a number of ways, just even little things like transporting a kid who was really going wild and having to make a stop on the freeway at a detention center just to calm the boy down, getting on JGIS and finding out he was deaf and being able to get an interpreter in to calm him down. Things like that, to being able to track by physical tattoos to be able to know that the kid is really not who he says he is, he's under an alias, things like that. It's the only system of its kind in the country, and it's the only system anywhere that has crossed governmental jurisdictions like that to be able to build a common database. It's expensive. The state pays for the data lines that make all this happen. But it has created, what it's done is pulled all the counties and the state together to create a system that calls things the same thing, so that we have a common definition for recidivism, for example, which we never had before, so that we can measure things in the same way. We're currently just finishing the development of the project, and we're building now the module that we hope will help us evaluate the effectiveness of programs that kids are in. I mean, we all, between the state and the county, spend millions of dollars on reformation programs, and we don't know a lot about their effectiveness. So the intent of this last module is that sometime in the future we would be able to know which kinds of programs work the best for which kinds of kids. So if any of you are particularly interested in data management and information systems, call and come over and we'll let you play around on a sample of it, because it really is amazing. It's, you haven't heard about it because nothing went wrong with it. I mean, it's
that's nice.
And that was our goal, is to stay off the front page of the paper. And it's been a success to that point.
Sure.
Senator Trump.
How's that funded, and is it in your budget to continue?
Yes, it is. It's in our budget. The struggle with it is it was unusually funded by certificates of participation. So the challenge was to move out of development from COPs onto general fund. And so in the governor's revised budget, it is funded along with a package that helps continue some of the funding that we got kind of mashed together through some federal funding, so we're hoping that that will maintain.
Other questions, comments? Does that conclude your remarks this morning?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we thank you both for your presentation. Is there anything further to come before the committee? If
tomorrow was good.
Great. All right, we are adjourned.